Welcome to the 22nd episode of The Lucid Truth. Today, I am interviewing Dr. Martin Ball. Dr. Ball is a scientist, artist, and visionary who hosts the Entheogenic Evolution podcast. He takes a unique non-dual approach to psychedelic experiences and the nature of consciousness, something I'm sure you will find interesting as you listen to this episode. So, now I bring you Dr. Martin Ball. Welcome, everyone. I'm here with Dr. Martin Ball from the Entheogenic Evolution podcast. Dr. Ball is an independent writer, researcher, musician, and visionary who focuses on the non-duality of entheogenic or psychedelic experiences. So let's start there. Dr. Ball, what is the idea of entheogenic non-duality, and how did you first come about understanding it?
Well, entheogen refers, it's a substitute word for the concept of psychedelics or hallucinogens. And the word itself means generating the experience of God within. So it's actually kind of a loaded term in that sense, that it's already starting from some kind of assumption. But it was a term that was coined by largely by cultural and historical researchers. Back in the 1960s, of course, Western culture got very interested in psychedelics, LSD, and actually there was considerable intellectual interest in psychedelics before that time. But in terms of mainstream awareness about psychedelics and, hippies taking acid or, taking psychedelic mushrooms, and the word psychedelic had been coined earlier, actually, by, more academics, intellectuals. Kind of moving beyond just the term hallucinogen. And psychedelic was coined to mean mind manifesting, which actually kind of shows sort of the intellectual roots of the term itself, right? That people were interested in aspects of the mind. They were interested in aspects of consciousness and how these different substances affect consciousness. But anyway, the term psychedelic kind of bled out into general culture, and it became, kind of lost that intellectual grounding and became more associated with sort of 1960s free-spirited hedonism, things like that. And so then as people were becoming more interested in and also learning that quote-unquote psychedelic substances have been used within many different cultures and generally as part of spiritual and religious traditions, not as not as a diversion, not as a form of entertainment, but under more rigorous spiritual and religious usage, that's where the term entheogen was then coined, but the idea of trying to set apart that, well, a psychedelic is something that somebody takes in like a social setting, but the same substance is then quote unquote an entheogen when it's used in some kind of spiritual or ceremonial context, and trying to distinguish both the historical and also the contemporary indigenous use of psychedelic substances as being something different than people going to a Grateful Dead concert and dropping acid, for example. Okay.
Right.
That's the first distinction of like, what does entheogen or entheogenic mean? So entheogenic would be, the experience that you get when you consume a psychedelic substance, but not in a social setting necessarily, or not in, an entertainment like setting, which I always like to, just say that I think that that's a perfectly legitimate use of a psychedelic, that there's nothing wrong with that, but there's another aspect, there's another way of approaching it. And the non-duality itself, I mean, the word is one of these odd words where it's defined by what it's not. And so usually when defining non-duality, I start with duality. And there's a lot of different applications for the concept of duality. You know, we have the conceptual level of right versus wrong, or good versus bad, light versus dark, right? It's a way of categorizing experience. It's a way of categorizing systems of thought. It's also used at a more metaphysical level to say, you know, like if we go to René Descartes, kind of the famous dualist philosopher who proposed that mind and body are fundamentally separate and distinct from each other. And he never quite figured out, well, if they are distinct, how do the two interact? But that we could call that metaphysical dualism, that mind is one thing, body is another thing, and by some mysterious means they interact with each other. Okay, so there's and at the more religious level, duality would be, for example, in the Western monotheistic traditions, Judaism, Christianity, Islam. You know, from a religious studies perspective, we could say that these are religions that focus on the numinous nature of God, which the definition for numinous was coined by this researcher named Rudolf Otto. And he described the numinous experience as the experience of the holy other, where it's kind of a play on words, because holy as in sacred, and holy also meaning entirely. So that within these religious traditions, God is something that stands outside of reality and is distinct from reality, and then goes poof, reality exists, and then poof, people exist, the world exists, but that God and quote unquote creation are separate and distinct from each other. And then also we have the dualist system of that. The idea of, well, the God is good, the devil is bad. There's this fundamental opposition of good and evil that exists within the universe. So there's lots of different applications, and I haven't even gotten to the mundane level. So the mundane level is I'm me, you're you. I'm me, this is my computer. I'm me, this is the house that I live in. And that all of these objects that exist within reality are fundamentally distinct and separate from each other. Okay, so that's duality. And this is, in most respects, this is our normal everyday experience. That, like, if I'm having emotional difficulties, I would say, well, here's a glass of water. It's different for me. It doesn't have any emotional difficulties at all. It's just a glass of water. It's fundamentally not me, whatever it is that I think that I am. So it's this basic division that we have within reality between subject, me, and the objects of my experience. And at the psychological level, duality would be defined along what are the borders of the ego, that the ego is in, and I don't mean it in a Freudian sense in any particular psychological school, but that the ego, I would define, is your sense of self. That what is it that is me versus what is it that is not me? And the way that I understand the ego is that it functions at this dualistic level, that in creating a sense of self and self-awareness around who it is that I think that I am, I also create what I think is not me, and objects, other people, things like that. Okay, so now non-duality. Non-duality means it's not that. All of these things that I've just described, it's not that. So if we were to put it into more positive language, it would be the unitary experience. So we could describe it as the direct experience that everything is somehow one. And at the, you know, theological level, we could say one of the ways that I would characterize it is that despite appearances and despite 99.99% of all of our experience that seems to be me versus everything else that exists, that actually there's only one being that exists, there's only one consciousness that exists, and I use the word God to refer to that. And so my position on non-duality is that everything and everyone in all places and all times, including this very moment right now, is this one universal consciousness that is experiencing and perceiving itself through multiple perspectives simultaneously, but that our egoic sense of self is really just a masking of this more universal consciousness of which we are all immediate expressions. So going back to entheogenic non-duality is that through the consumption of entheogens and through their directed use, through the focus of how you're working with them, that you, me, anyone potentially can have a non-dual experience. And this is the experience that most people never have in their lives. But when you do have it, which I have had, it tends to pretty radically change your perspective on what is the nature of reality. And for me, I posit that this is the fundamental ground of being. This is the most true experience you could have. And I personally see a lot of value in that. So kind of it in a nutshell. I know I use a lot of words to explain all of that, but
No, that was great. That was great. I in terms of the term entheogen, I kind of learned the hard way when I was talking with Rick Strassman, and I called DMT, NN-DMT, an entheogen. And he said, well, it's not maybe always an entheogen. It depends on the context of the experience. And I thought that was pretty interesting. In terms of what you said about God, I like to think about, a lot of people think about God as being on the top dimension and we're way down at the bottom, right? But what if you flip that and God's at the base and it's a force that permeates through everything? And if we view that force as a force of consciousness, it makes a lot of sense in terms of what you're talking about in terms of non-duality. So how do you think your postulations about consciousness and non-duality, do you think they relate to panpsychism at all? The belief that the universe is conscious and consciousness is a force of reality? Do you think there's a connection to be drawn there? Or maybe those are two more separate ideas?
No, I'd say that they're fundamentally related, that it's really, if we start from this understanding that there is this one universal consciousness that is everything, that in fact, everything that we perceive as material objects are manifestations of patterns of energy that exist within the consciousness that is quote unquote God, that is reality. So that ultimately everything that we could ever experience, everything that we could ever know, exists within this universal consciousness, is one way that we could put it. Now, that universal consciousness does not express itself the same way through all the objects of existence. So like if we can ask, well, is the glass of water, is this as conscious as I am as a human being? And my answer to that is, well, obviously no. You know, the glass of water doesn't get to make a whole lot of choices about what it's thinking or what it's doing. Right. I do, because I'm a human being. And so that's where I like to use the term vehicles, that as human beings, we are vehicles for this consciousness to really fully express, experience, and know itself. And that the physical makeup of the glass of water doesn't allow for that level of complexity to express itself. But that underneath it all, yes, the glass of water exists within universal consciousness in the same way that I do as a physical being. So yeah, we can say panpsychism, but that doesn't mean that I can talk to, you know, in my experience, it doesn't mean I can talk to the glass of water if I want, but Parker's not going to answer me back because it's just a glass of water. Right. And if I do think that it's talking back to me, I would describe that as a mental projection. But, you know, water doesn't talk. There's no mouth there, you know, but right. it still exists within consciousness. And it at the in what I call the individuated level, it's clearly as an object, it's separate from my physical body. But the question is, where is the boundary of the true nature of the self? And that my position is that the boundary is not actually where the ego stops. That there actually is no boundary, so that in the most fundamental sense, the glass of water is also myself, because I am the universal consciousness, just as much as you are the universal consciousness, as is the glass of water is also the universal consciousness. So in that sense, yes, everything literally is one. Everything literally exists within consciousness. Everything is responsive to consciousness in one way or another. But the way that it gets expressed is limited by the function of the vehicle, by the physical makeup of the vehicle itself.
Right, which makes a distinction between you and the water. Even if there's some level of consciousness that's consistent and stable, if consciousness is what it's like to be something, or a form of awareness, then it's possible, if it's a universal force, that it's like something to be an atom, it's like something to be the whole universe, it's like something to be a glass of water. But those experiences, they're going to be much different depending on the vehicle. And if you relate that to God, it would be very incomprehensible to be infinity all at once, probably even for an infinite being. But if you fracture your consciousness and divide it into individualized subunits, you can experience yourself through yourself as yourself, which seems kind of along the lines of what you're referring to in terms of non-duality and consciousness. Would you say that's a good example?
Yeah, that, you know, the everything all at once, all the time experience is, in a sense, I mean, paradoxically, it's not really an experience. It's more of a state. And as a human being, we can enter into that experience and we can be there and then we can come out of it. But you can't stay there. If you stay there, then there's nothing to do. There's nothing to experience. There's no life to be lived. And we're living beings. So this is, you know, it's not like, yeah, I'm just going to be there all the time, because then there's no you there, right? So that what I just like to refer to it as the reality project, that what we experience as reality is this project that God has initiated by creating internal divisions, which I would refer to as energetic structures, which allow for the unfolding of what we can perceive as the evolution of the universe, the evolution of life, the evolution of consciousness, as well as our day-to-day experience. And that this is necessary in order for there to be a perceiver and things to be perceived. And that this ultimately is what, quote unquote, God is doing, that God is the unfolding of the reality project. And it is doing it so that it can experience and know itself. And even at a more fundamental level, that it is just simply being itself, which also for me removes any kind of metaphysical purpose, you know, like, well, like, what's the point of living? You know, what's the point of being a human being? Well, the only point is to be a human being and to perceive and experience and to live. That there's no ultimate goal to reality. There's no ultimate quest that any human being needs to go on, other than the personal challenge of, can you be yourself? Can you figure out what yourself is? And can you be true to that? And that's really, that's all that there is.
Okay, so I think we can communicate this idea in words, but I think psychedelics, where they come into play, is you might not be willing to accept it without a psychedelic experience. It might not make sense. I think, like with 5-MeO-DMT or with ayahuasca, you might need a powerful representation of the capacities of consciousness to be able to understand the extent of this. So you mentioned the meaning of life, and I think if you think about it, consciousness itself seems to be really, it contains all value. It's the carrier of it. Because without consciousness, what could mean anything at all? And if everything is conscious, then everything has value. Everything means something. Not like a destination in and of itself. I like how you put it. It's just being that thing that is important and has value. And so if consciousness carries all subjective value, it seems to be objectively valuable. And I think that's true, even regardless of what metaphysical truth is real. If consciousness is a fundamental force, or even if it's an emergent property, we have consciousness ourselves. And so that's why I think life has value in and of itself and is important. So what do you think about the meaning of life in terms of its relationship to consciousness. Do you think that there's a fundamental connection between value and the capacity to experience something? Because consciousness as an experiential property seems to be necessitated for meaning to exist in the first place. So what do you think about that?
Well, I think when we start talking about value and meaning, I think that it does get a little bit tricky, because meaning usually is an imposition from a perspective onto, you know, if we ask, well, what does this mean? And then we want to create a narrative and a story and a context and a system in order to generate systems of meaning. And so one of the things that I say is that nothing means anything. And also at the same time, everything means everything that it can possibly mean to anyone, because meaning is a subjective experience. And in terms of value, I guess I would look at it more at a functional nature, that it's really important for quarks to be quarks, because if quarks aren't quarks, then we don't get atoms. And it's really important for atoms to be atoms, because without atoms, we don't get molecules. And it's really important for molecules to be molecules, but without molecules, then we don't get substances. And without substances, then we don't get physical properties, you know? And so all of these things, it's like everything is the way that it is because it needs to be that way in order for the reality project to function as a coherent and comprehensive system that can sustain itself throughout what we perceive as space and time. And so everything has the value that it needs to have in order for things to exist. But you know, when we ask, well, okay, well, what does that mean? It's like, well, it just means that things are as they are. And that, you know, at the personal level, that's why I always try and steer people away from, you know, I do a lot of consultations with people about their psychedelic experiences, and they want to know, well, what does this mean? And a lot of people, they develop stories around it, and they create narratives around it. And they say, well, I had this experience, so this means I need to do this, or I need to do that, or I should be this kind of person, or I should be that. And I tell them, no, it doesn't mean anything. That really, what I like people to focus on is, what is the energy? And are you being authentic with the energy of your experience? Or are you limiting it? Are you trying to shape it in a particular way? Are you trying to withhold? Are you indulging? Or are you being authentic and present with how you are, as you are, and allowing yourself to be and express that? And that for me, that's what tends to show up with people's psychedelic experiences, is either ability to fully be with the energy that they are, or encounter their own levels of resistance, their own levels of constructed identity, their own levels of meaning. And that's why in the non-dual experience, you transcend all of that and you go fully into, oh, this is the immediate energy of being. It's all one. It's everything all the time. It's universal. And kind of going back to an earlier statement that you said, that this is the kind of thing that, in my personal experience, this was something that, you know, I have my PhD in religious studies. I've studied religious experience and religious traditions and religious practices and all of that. And I had the intellectual understanding that, okay, well, I think everything's one. This seems to make sense to me. But one of the things that I learned through my own direct experience of the non-dual experience is that any idea I had of what that was, wasn't it. And so this is where it's really hard to capture in language, because language is inherently dualistic. It's dividing the world and our experience into concepts, into things, and that this word is not that word, right? But it's like it's all words all at once. And so when you've had the experience, then you can say with like authority, it's like, wow, I guess everything really is all one, but I didn't understand what that really means. And not that I necessarily understand now, but because I've had the experience, I can affirm that this is no longer just a belief or an idea that I have accepted, but it is something much more palpable and direct than that.
Right. It's something that can be realized within the contents of consciousness with the right supplementation or maybe meditation exercise, anything along those lines. So there is a reality that's being seen that you're trying to express. I like the term energin that you, I think, coined. The reason I like it is because entheogen ascribes a spiritual component that maybe some atheists or people who don't ascribe to spirituality might not agree with. So it's nice to give them a term like that. Poetogen is another interesting one I've heard. Same guy that coined that coined the term psyche knot instead of psychonaut, which I always thought was fun. But have you ever heard of Douglas Harding? He talks about the headless way, and he's the man without a head, right? But he's got a head. Don't get me wrong. He's not the headless horseman. But his argument is that you don't really have a head when you look for it. But what you do see is this empty space of awareness. And it has to be empty, because if it was full, nothing could fit in it. And since consciousness is this empty space, it makes room for everything. I wouldn't necessarily agree that it's empty, because there's this inner landscape that's very full that the contents of consciousness can experience. But it seems very similar to what you're saying about non-duality, because this inner light of consciousness is what all beings share. Everyone that has it is one. And it sounds, I like the way you put it a little better, because when you start going around telling people they don't have a head, they look at you really funny. And it's I like Douglas Harding, but it's a hard way of pitching the concept. So I was wondering if you ever have heard of him, because it's similar, but it's just so abstract.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with him, and I haven't heard that expression before.
Well, later, look for your own head and see if you can find it for me. Let me know what happens.
Yeah, well, I would say that, you know, a relationship that I would see here to the non-dual experience is that it's this incredible irony that the more you go looking for it, the less likely you are to find it, because it's the striving after the experience itself is the actions of the ego, but the non-dual experience is the transcending of the ego. And so the ego can't do anything to actually achieve the experience. So, you know, back when I was a graduate student, I had a professor who actually had been a student of the Dalai Lama. And one of his phrases that he liked to say was like, "Can a sword turn so fast that it could cut its own self?" And of course the answer is no. And that's kind of like this question of the ego. Like, well, if the non-dual experience is only available through transcending the ego, is there anything that the ego can do in order to transcend itself? And it's no. And, you know, in Buddhism, it kind of deals with this ironic situation. So like in Buddhism, they say that in order to convince yourself to start to follow the Buddhist path, you have to develop bodhicitta. You have to develop this enlightenment mind, and you have to really, really want it, which of course is an expression of the ego. Anything that you want is an expression of the ego. So first you have to really, really want it. So you have to dedicate yourself to it. But then the further you go into the process, the more it is the stripping away of the ego, and stripping the way of action, stripping away of doing. And, you know, in the ideal situation is finally, if you can do enough of that, if you can do enough of nothing through learning how your ego is functioning and then not doing that, that then you just might find yourself in the infinite spaciousness of the clear light of the mind, and that suddenly you're there, but you can't put yourself there. So here is where entheogens or energens, as you know, you've mentioned that is a phrase that I coined. Going back to the idea that, you know, if we can remove psychedelic, we can remove the term entheogen, and if we just say energen, it's something that generates energy or affects our experience of energy. That I characterize the ego as a collection of limited energetic structures that creates, all collectively, it creates a persona, it creates a personality, it influences your facial expressions, you know, that some people don't want to walk around like this all the time, you know, so they're holding energy that way, or, you know, Some people walk around like that all the time and they're holding their energy that way. Or some people are like this all the time. And hey, I'm holding my energy this way. And it affects your tone of voice. Yeah, some people just, you know, like to talk up here like that, you know. And other people, they want to talk like way down here. And then, you know, other people, they want to gesticulate a lot with their hands, you know. Or other people, they just, well, I'm going to talk to you this way, right? So there's all these patterns of ways that we are expressing and mobilizing energy. And because we're self-aware beings, that we identify with them. And people will say, oh, well, I was myself, or I wasn't myself, you know, like, oh, they're like that expression that I had, well, that wasn't really me, you know. So we identify with it. But there's just these habitual patterns of energy that we have cultivated since childhood, and that we use that to identify, well, this is me. So if you take a powerful energen that is radically going to change your energetic experience, you have the potential to completely dissolve and move beyond your identifiable energetic structures, which is quote unquote your ego. And that, so as a tool, and here's where I usually point to 5-MeO-DMT because it's the most powerful of these tools, that it holds the potential to completely dissolve all of the energetic structures of your ego within a matter of seconds, yet awareness persists. Awareness is not tied to the ego. Awareness simply exists. And so you can move beyond all these energetic structures of the ego, and then you can enter into this state of infinite energetic experience. And then that is the non-dual experience. Now, people can also use a meditation path to get there, but it's really slow, it's really hard. And even there, I actually have my doubts that most people really get to the fullness, the full infinite nature of the experience. And I make that claim having worked with a variety of people who have had years and years of practice of meditation. And, you know, in my experience, other people, they can have their own experience. But in my experience, people who feel that they've had a non-dual experience and then are given the opportunity to experience 5-MeO-DMT and release fully into it, I have never seen a single person come back from that experience and say, oh, I've had that experience before. Every single person has come back and said, I thought I've had a full non-dual experience before. I now realize I wasn't anywhere close, because that was so beyond anything I've ever experienced that, okay, that's going to put my meditation experience into a different perspective. So wow. That's my experience.
That's interesting. I definitely need to make sure I try that someday, because I've only had ayahuasca with the Santo Daime Church. And that was definitely an interesting experience in Brazil. They had a funny thing where they said Jesus turned water into daime, which is a form of ayahuasca, for anyone that doesn't know, instead of wine, which, you know, why would he make something that descends your consciousness? He would make one that raises it to the creator. I just always thought that was interesting local lore. So, okay, in terms of the self, right? The self, in terms of the egocentric self, or as the Buddha put it, that's the root of all suffering, right? The dukkha. But what if you could view the self as that space of awareness, the thing that persists within the psychedelic experience, the awareness that you are, the headlessness, as Douglas Harding would put it? It seems like that you could call that the self, but it's not the normal self. It's not the homunculus in the head that's controlling experience or the thinker of thoughts. It's more of a space of consciousness that not only you are, but everyone is as well. And I think you could identify yourself with that, because I think people are tied to an idea of the self. And even if it's not the ego, you could have one that makes more sense. Alan Watts puts it very well, I think, when he says, you are what the universe is doing at the moment you exist. All the universal forces leading you to act, those are you. The universe doesn't happen to you, it happens through you. So what do you think about identifying yourself with that space of consciousness instead of with the traditional construct of the ego. Do you think that's still the ego, maybe ascending a layer and trying to say, look, I'm still a self? Or do you think maybe that's a really accurate way of putting it?
No, I think that that is the most accurate way to put it. And so to put it into kind of provocative language, you know, I am Martin. That is the person that I am. Hello, I'm Martin. This is me. This is my life. I have my own struggles. I have my own abilities. I have my own talents. I have my own problems. That's all me as my life, as Martin. But Martin is just a character that I am playing. And so I am Martin, but I am also God. And that's the most provocative way that I can think to say it. But it's also fundamentally true. And see, where we get egoic inflation is if I were to say, Martin is God. That's just fucked up, okay?
Ah, I see what you did there.
Yeah, but see, I, the true nature of I, is I am God, I am Martin, I am you, I am the water, I am the computer, I am the far distant galaxies spinning out through space. I am all of that. Most of the time, I'm not identified with that because I have to deal with the localized version of myself, just like we all do. The localized version of myself is Martin. That's the one I've got to take care of. That's the one I've got to live with through every moment of my existence, right? But that's not the ultimate nature of myself. So in the non-dual experience, when there is awareness there, what does not go away ever is the sense, I am. And it's this universal sense, I am. And then when you come back down from that, it's like, I am, and I am Martin, and I'm still here. And they're like, look, reality is still happening. You know, it does. And so here's one of the things about it. I think it's a really important experience for people to have because it puts yourself, your life, your issues, your problems, puts all of that into the ultimate perspective. But it doesn't fix a goddamn thing. It doesn't solve anything for anyone. You know, that people, especially people, I like to tell people who are chasing after it, that they're like, oh man, I want to have this experience so that, you know, everything will be right in my life. It's like, well, you're fucking deluded. This is not going to solve a single thing for you. What it can do is help you learn the difference between what's authentic and true and what is contrived and forced and constructed, and therefore can help you more thoroughly and authentically be the individual that you are and help you to free yourself from your attachments, from your illusions, from your projections. But that takes dedication on the part of the individual. And there is where the benefit really lies. And that even this, it doesn't necessarily make you happier. It doesn't, again, it doesn't solve your problems, but it helps you be the self that you are in a way that has a greater sense of harmony and authenticity. And I would also say, as a byproduct, it can greatly extend your sense of compassion. Because when you really honestly, I mean, this is just my honest view, is that I am you. You are me. We're the same being. And so how I treat you, how I interact with you, is a reflection of how I interact with myself. And I desire to interact with myself authentically. I desire to interact with myself in a way that is the most expressive of truth as is possible. And it can change your relationship to everyone and everything, if you let it. And it can also, I mean, I've seen plenty of people that, you know, they come through this and then they do the conflation of their ego with like, oh, well, so then that's me. Yeah, that really is me. And then, well, then it just becomes another layer of ego. But the full awareness is, yeah, that the I am persists. The I am is universal and the I am persists.
Yeah, the ego does like to jump up layers at times, but psychedelic, it is mind manifesting. So looking for an extremely different outlook in life is maybe a little bit optimistic, but I do think it's possible, like you said, to be very helpful if you allow it to be, because psychedelics show you the value of consciousness at its core, and you see all beings share consciousness. You're all this conscious space of awareness that everything is appearing in. And I like to point out for skeptics that it doesn't matter if, say, panpsychism is true or if consciousness really extends past the brain. This is true regardless of the metaphysical or physical reality of existence, because regardless, we're still conscious creatures. And then you do realize that if you are this space of awareness at your core, at the very center, then you do start treating other people better. And it does extend your gratitude in ways that otherwise might have been impossible to do. And in terms of being God, right, it's not like the deistic God. So I don't like to say I'm atheist. I like to say I'm a deist, right? Yeah. Which is a term that not very many people are familiar with, but it's not this deity that's creating things and its own conscious will and intention. It's more of a force of consciousness that all beings share and all things might share in the case of panpsychism. But that point is, you know, it's kind of hard to prove whether or not that's true. When you have the experience, I think you can really see it more clearly in a way that science might not be able to verify, at least not anytime soon. So I think that it can be provocative, like you said, but it's a different conception of what God is. And when you realize that, it's not as provocative as it might seem initially.
Yeah, yeah. It's not, you know, I'm not talking about the religious God. I'm not talking about the mythological God. You know, I ended up choosing to use the word God to describe this because in my first full non-dual experience with 5-MeO-DMT, it's just like, oh, thank you, God. That's what I said. And it was really? Like, okay, I'm sticking with it. And I was the kind of person who was always like, ooh, like, don't even use that word. Like, oh, this is like Western monotheistic traditions in the Bible and all that bullshit. And I don't believe any of that. And so fucking keep that word away from me. But that's what authentically came out of my mouth. And so I've been kind of living with that. And, you know, this actually reminds me of many years ago now when I was kind of dealing with this question of God. And there was this one guy who was on this panel with me, and he's like, well, if your God exists, then you should be able to make God, you know, have thunder and lightning right now. And it's like, dude, that's not how it works. You're working from the completely wrong concept of what you think God is, that you're coming from your idea set.
Set me on fire right now, Martin.
But this is, yeah, it's like, dude, look around in reality, okay? This is God working right now. This is what God does. And it's not like, you know, this is why I also say, like, well, prayer, I mean, you're not praying to anybody. There's nobody there at the other end of the line because it's you. This is also why I think that most religion is just a bunch of ideas that people made up that about what they think, how they want to navigate this relationship, but that ultimately it's all just you. And so that's also why, you know, I refer to myself as being non-spiritual and non-religious, because I don't buy into any of those concepts, because it's just reality. And reality is this one universal consciousness. And there's nothing you can do about it. There's nothing you need to do about it. And it does not require any kind of religiosity or any kind of spirituality. It's just the nature of being. And that, you know, going back to, well, can you prove it or not? No, you can't. But you can have a non-dual experience, and then you'll be free to make up your own mind about if you think things really are one or not. And that's kind of the beauty of it. That, because, you know, this is another question that people ask me, like, well, is that just an effect of the drug? And so is it just another experience? And maybe it's not true. And my response to that is, well, you know, people who have this experience, they generally feel that it's the most true experience they've ever had. And, you know, what else do we have to go on?
Right. Well, with Rick Strassman's research, he said that he was not expecting this. The people came back saying it was more real than real. And he was like, no, it's just a drug. And they were like, no, it was more. And he was like, what the heck? And then the spirit molecule is produced. And, you know, it really makes you think that there's something there to be found, because this experience is something that does exist within consciousness. It is something that can be seen within its contents. So that warrants explanation. So I think a good way that you've put this before, I'd like you to share this with us today, is the difference between enlightenment and an enlightenment experience. So how do you kind of see the distinction between those two concepts?
Yeah, so first of all, I would want to remove like any kind of religious connotation around the idea of enlightenment. So, you know, I mean, this is a word that mostly when people are thinking of enlightenment, that this is something that comes from, you know, Buddhism or Hinduism, and it's connected to the idea of perceiving the true nature of reality, which therefore prevents you from reincarnating into the next life. And this is a place where I say, look, I think the whole concept of reincarnation is just bullshit. I just think it's not a thing, because there's only one consciousness and it's all beings all the time. So if you think, well, like my soul is going through multiple permutations to finally reach this point of enlightenment, but then I can finally get the hell out of this thing. I think that's what I'm talking about the projection of meaning and then projection of value and purpose onto reality. That for me, that those are all just expressions of the ego. So when I'm talking about enlightenment, I'm not talking about anything like that. Now, an enlightenment experience would be, my definition, would be a non-dual experience. That it's the sense of, oh, wow, you know, it really is all one. So here it is. It's all one. This is it, right? This is the truest experience I could have. And it's beyond my normal sense of self. And it encompasses everything in all time and all places. And it's one. Okay, so that's the enlightenment experience. And that's something that is fairly easily facilitated through the consumption of 5-MeO-DMT. Now, enlightenment as an embodied experience, that's the first thing I would come to, is that it's an embodied experience. It's not some rarefied, oh, I'm existing in pure consciousness all the time and I'm just in the oneness, man. You know, it's not that. That through the vehicle that we experience ourselves, the human vehicle, we can either be true to ourselves, be true to our energy, and be true to our experience and our expression, or we can try and turn it into something through our ego. We can hold back. We could tell people what they want to hear. We can try and be what we think other people want us to be, or we could just be ourselves. And we can do that without our self-imposed limitations that we have created through our identification with our ego. Okay? So that for me, enlightenment means, have you learned how to be yourself? And can you do that consistently? And even though, and there's another thing that I always like to point out, is that my definition of enlightenment does not mean, quote unquote, killing your ego. That your ego is a part of you. It's a part of your human experience. And you can transcend it temporarily, but it doesn't go away. You still have your ego. But it's a matter of, are you letting your ego run you through the unconscious patterns and choices that you have adopted? Or do you give yourself permission to be yourself as you are in any given moment? And if you can do that, even when your ego gets in there and messes with you, and, you know, it's kind of hard to do all the time, so you got to self-correct. Oh, there's my son, Jaden.
Aw.
And it has, you know, multiple challenges to it. But if you can do that consistently and feel that, well, I'm being myself, and I'm not trying to be anything. I'm just being as I am. And that means embracing the full spectrum of the human experience, the full spectrum of human emotion, the full spectrum of human thought, and being that, then you're not trapped by the idea of who you think you should be, and you're giving yourself permission to be the you that you are. And so here, again, this is why having the foundation of the non-dual experience is very important, because it very clearly informs you, oh, I'm not my ego. that's not the limitation of what I am. And that you can then see, oh, well, these are the places where I've held myself back. These are the places where I've denied myself. These are the places where I've closed myself off. And I guess another way that I would put it is that through the ego, most of us spend a lot of time guarding and protecting our hearts. And that the quote unquote enlightenment is learning how to open your heart and to keep it open, even when it's hard. And to not go through life of gonna blame this, gonna blame that, but be with the reality of what's in your heart and live that to the best of your ability and to live that authentically. So for me, it's a very, very embodied question. And it's not just some mental realization that all is one. It's okay, okay, great, all is one. Now, what are you going to do about it? How are you going to let that inform your life, inform your choices, inform your actions, and how you're going to allow yourself to be or not? You know, so for me, one of the ways that this manifested was that after going through these experiences and this kind of energetic reformatting that I went through, it was like, wow, I really got a lot to say about this, but I know that a lot of people aren't going to like what I have to say about this, and that it's going to be very controversial and it's going to be very provocative. But if I'm going to be true to myself, I'm going to let myself say it. I'm going to let myself do it. I'm going to let myself be that. And there's a level of inner peace, in a sense, or at least inner satisfaction with yourself, that even if other people don't like it, you're being true to yourself. And you've given yourself permission to say and do what you feel that you really must, because your energy is there. And rather than holding back and trying to be something for someone or anyone, you be yourself as you are. And sometimes that's easy for other people to take, and sometimes it's not. And, you know, as I shared with you, I'm not going to get into the details at the moment, but as I shared with you before we started this interview, I'm currently going through a very difficult process of that right now. And it's about, how do I be with that?
Yeah, thank you for that. It seems like what you're talking about is a form of practicing integration. And when you have the enlightenment experience, that's not really enough, because you need to integrate it into your life to be able to really feel what enlightenment is. And so in terms of the ego, I like the phrase, a good servant, but a bad master. You don't want it to be leading you around, but you don't want to completely give up on it either. It's like a child. It can do crazy, dangerous things if it's led astray, or it can do amazing things if it's taught how to do it. So you just kind of want to lead it forward. And so it sounds like to me, the actualization of the concept of free will, to be able to transcend the traditional limitations of your ego and be who you really are without limitation. And so I'm curious, how do you think of free will in relation to non-duality? Because I know there's a dividing line between concepts, and I think a lot of it is semantic. So, and that's one of the problems with language, like we were talking about earlier. So do you think that saying that it's an actualization of free will to reach this state of enlightenment and integrate it fully, do you think that's misleading, or do you think it's potentially true?
Well, look, the reality is that we always experience choice. You know, whether quote unquote free will actually exists or not, or everything is predetermined and we're just one great big machine of energetic transformations that are taking place and we just have the illusion that we're making choice. Well, it's a pretty damn persistent illusion that you get to choose. You know, it's like the example that I was giving before, that when I went through this process myself, I had the opportunity to choose. Like, look, I could say nothing to no one and not make waves and, you know, get along with others in a way, you know, that holding back would allow me to do. Or I could just say, fuck it. I'm going to be who I am. I'm going to do what I do, and I'm going to say what I say, and I'm going to live it to the most fullest extent that I can. Now, did I really have a choice? I don't know. It sure seemed like it to me. And that this is a moment-to-moment thing, that you can either be authentic with where you really are at and what you're really feeling, or you can hold back and you can try and be something else. And usually we do that to protect ourselves or our image of ourselves or other people and our images of other people. So, you know, it's a persistent question. And that's one of the things that I always tell people when consulting on these kinds of things, is that you got to come back to where you are in any given moment and then ask yourself, am I being true to that? Or am I avoiding? Am I indulging? Am I projecting? Am I holding on to something? That here again, the infinite non-dual experience is the truest experience of energy. And that's why it feels so real for people, because it's like, wow, this is ultimate truth. I'm feeling it. It's not just I'm thinking it. It's I'm feeling it. And that you can feel when you're bullshitting yourself. You can feel when you're bullshitting others. You can feel when you're not being authentic. Now, this is something that people often they need training on. They need practice, because through the ego, we've had a whole lifetime of learning how to bullshit ourselves, but we haven't had a whole lifetime of learning how to be authentic with ourselves. So this is something that generally takes time, and it's a process, and it can be painful. It can be scary. It can require a lot of letting go of things that formerly made you feel secure and safe and sometimes even happy. And that the willingness to go through that means that you can free yourself from these things. And then, you know, going back to the ego again, so it is kind of like a retraining of the ego, that the ego is what allows us to be the social beings that we are. And if you want to continue to be a social being, then you're probably going to need your ego. So, you know, going back to this concept that, you know, a lot of people throw around, is like, oh, you got to kill your ego. It's like, you know, is cutting off your hand, is that going to help you be enlightened? You know, what's that going to do for you? You're just not going to have a hand. That
right.
Your hand is functional. Well, your ego is functional as well. There's nothing, it's not inherently bad. It's just most of us have been confused by our identification with it throughout the course of our lives. And we haven't been able to imagine ourselves of what we are beyond that. And that you can experience yourself beyond that. But then it comes down to, well, how do I live my life and express myself on a moment-to-moment basis, again, in a way that is fully embodied and is authentic for who I am, with where I am in any given moment? And so that's a continual question, you know, and it's not just like, hey, I did it once, so yeah, I'm all done. It's like, no, you got to keep doing that every moment. You got to keep going back to that.
Right. It's more of a process and less of a isolated incident. And so if free will does exist, this is how you actualize it. So, okay, I want to consult your religious expertise, since you said that's what your PhD is in. So in relation to psychedelics, so we go back to, a lot of people talk about the stoned ape theory, which Terence McKenna coined the term of, but the actual concept originated with Huxley in the term of the form of neurotheology, which is the idea that psychedelics generated human consciousness to the degree that it differentiated us from other beings. So there's a lot of speculation about the origin of religion and psychedelics. A lot of Wasson's work was based on that. So the origin of religion in terms of the Rig Veda, right? The Rig Veda is the oldest religious text that is based on a religion that still exists. And they talk about the soma, and the soma is like a psychedelic brew that's really popularized in that context. And it seems like psychedelics were associated with the start of religion, but I've read some scholars postulate that psychedelics weren't necessitated for the origin of religion, but they were a part of it. So religion would have started without psychedelics, but they are a part of it too. And they're a small piece of it. Or some people think they're a larger piece of it. So how do you think psychedelics play into the origin of religion and human consciousness?
Yeah, well, the first thing that I would say is that what religion originates out of is through human self-awareness. And, you know, whatever it is that evolutionarily drove us along that path to develop a really complex self-awareness. In other words, the emergence of the human ego. And maybe that was monkeys, you know, eating mushrooms. I don't know. You know, I consider that to be rather speculative. I mean, we can't ever prove that. Right. But we do know that at some point, human beings became self-aware and developed the modern human ego. And that we know through archaeology that at some point, human beings started burying their dead. And so that shows that there's some kind of concept of, well, there's me, and there's life, and then there's death, and then there's some sense of needing to do something to recognize that. So this is a level of self-awareness that becomes developed. And you seem to be frozen, so maybe we're frozen?
I gotcha.
Okay.
Good?
Okay, that's better. Yeah. So I would say first and foremost that religion develops out of the human ego, because the human ego is the self-reflection function within consciousness that's able to say, hey, I'm me, I'm here. And then it's also able to ask, well, where the fuck am I? What the hell is this? And who am I? And what am I supposed to do? And is there anybody in charge? And what am I supposed to do about it? You know, so, you know, I talk about my dog a lot. She's not in the room right now. But she doesn't have that. She doesn't have that. You know, she's just a dog. She's like, oh, cat, bark. Dinner, 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 pet me, pet me, pet me. She's not, you know, asking these self-referential questions that we're able to do as a human being. So first and foremost, it's the ego that gives rise to religion, because it's the ego that allows us to question the nature of our existence. And religion becomes an answer to our questions about the nature of existence. Now, also in the anthropological level, that, you know, before large-scale societies and modern large-scale religions, we all lived in small tribal groups. And that most likely there, in small tribal groups, we were existing in more shamanic forms of religious and spiritual expression. And that as human beings moved around the planet, that we experimented with all the plants and fungi and everything that we ever came across. And some of them were found to, wow, this really changes our experience, that we're able to then perceive and experience things that we don't otherwise. And so the use of psychedelics, you know, pretty much anywhere in the world that there is something in the environment that produces a psychedelic experience, it's generally part of the local religious or spiritual tradition, right? So like there's a whole variety of different psychedelic mushrooms that exist in Mexico, and there's psychedelic cacti, and there's psychedelic sage plants, and that they're all used as part of the religious traditions. And, you know, when we look at Europe, there's all kinds of psychoactive plants that are used in Europe. And, you know, they were part of the indigenous traditions there. So anywhere you go around the world and you find people and there's some kind of psychedelic plant or fungi in the local environment, generally it's being used. And so then when we get to things like the Rig Veda in Hinduism, that it's absolutely no surprise that kind of the core of it is the production of soma, of this super top secret, can't mention the ingredients, drink that says, drink this and you'll realize that you're immortal, right? This is the divine nectar of immortality. This is Amrita. You know, you go, and this actually seems to be a theme in the Indo-European language family, because, you know, Aryans, that this group of people migrated out of, you know, Eastern Europe. And these people went into India and then created the Rig Veda and Soma as this drink of enlightenment. And this same family, the same language family, same cultural group, they migrated into Persia, and eventually the development of the religion of Zoroastrianism, which has the divine drink of Heoma. And they also moved into the Mediterranean and formed the basis for Hellenic Greek culture and the divine drink of Kaikion that was served within the mystery cults within European Hellenic culture. And so, yeah, the roots of religion are intimately tied to mind-altering plants and substances. And this is something that's just true all around the world. And that the roots of it are certainly there. And the reason why they're used is because they work. Because people can take these things and you can have an experience. And you can experience quote-unquote other realms, you can experience quote-unquote entities, you can experience heavenly realms and hellish realms, and you can also experience, oh shit, it's all one. And that's something that these things make accessible. And the reason that they work that way is because they're essentially neurotransmitters. The human body naturally produces DMT and 5-MeO-DMT. We have the endocannabinoid system. So, of course, every culture that encountered marijuana is like, fuck yeah, let's use some of that. Because it fits right with our natural biochemistry, right? This is just how we've evolved. And so, yeah, they're part of religion and they're part of spiritual traditions simply because they work. You know, there's no more mystery to it than that. They work.
Yes, they definitely work. I like the way Terence McKenna put it when he said, meditation, it might work, it might not work, but 3.5 grams of mushrooms in a blindfolded room with the lights off will always work. And there's something about the consistency that's reliable and special.
And actually, just picking up on that, one of the things that anthropologists and the historians of religion even look at is that the meditation and yoga traditions that come out of India, that they're actually saying that, well, probably it was grounded originally in the consumption of psychedelics and entheogens and use of cannabis and things like that. But then as these religions moved into areas where these plants and substances were no longer available, then there was the internalization of the process through yoga and meditation as essentially as a substitute for the original experience that was available through the consumption of the substances themselves.
That's interesting. I'd never thought about it like that. That makes sense. Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, it's funny because this is kind of related to the same topic. You know how Ancient Aliens, they say these cave drawings are evidence that aliens came here? Weird cave drawings. If you look at those regions, there's a higher level of endogenous entheogens that grow there. So it's more likely that they were actually depicting their psychedelic experiences, which I find fascinating. And it makes sense why that might be misinterpreted for extraterrestrial contact, but it might have been extra dimensional. So I'm not sure how you feel about the existence of other dimensions in terms of psychedelic experiences. I'm not sure how I feel about it either. With DMT, NMDMT specifically, there's a lot of misconceptions. A lot of people say it's made in the pineal gland, that's your third eye. Well, people with their pineal gland removed from their brain, pinorectomy, they're fine, no differences. So it's not a very special third eye. DMT seems to be mainly produced in the lungs.
Yeah.
Which makes sense when you think about meditation and breathing. Maybe that produces more of it that way. So probably not released during dreams or death either, although it might be. But it seems like if something were to connect you with another dimension, which isn't to say that our dimension is now meaningful because another dimension exists. You know, we're fine without it. But what if this other dimension does exist? What I'm interested in is potentially testing that hypothesis. So I want to run you past this experiment idea real quick. What if we gave someone maybe even 5-MeO-DMT? I'm not sure how extra-dimensional contact works on 5-MeO, but with NN, we could give someone NN-DMT, send them to the hyperspace, tell the beings there a number, like 23, then send someone else and ask what the number was. I have a friend who said it would probably be better to do songs, actually, because they communicate in songs and not numbers, so we should use their language instead of ours. And it might be a way to reliably verify the objectivity of an alternate dimension with the use of psychedelics. So what do you think about that and its relationship with 5-MeO?
Well, I would say that it fundamentally runs into the problem of non-duality, okay? Now, my position is that, like with NN-DMT or just DMT, most people don't transcend the ego. that it is, because it's a hyper visual medium, that it actually reinforces subject object duality.
Because interesting.
There is, I am seeing other beings in other realms. And what are those other realms? You see, it goes back to the same fundamental religious question, right? Of, I'm here, what is all of this? Now, my position is that all of these beings and entities, these are just projections of the mind that exist within consciousness, but they don't exist independently. That it's not actually a quote unquote another dimension. It's not a stable reality in that sense. And even with this objectivity hypothesis that you're proposing here, that if all consciousness really is one, then even if somebody comes back with the same number or the same song, it doesn't mean that that's an objective reality. It just means that actually consciousness is one, and that we all, at some level, we all have access to the same information potentially.
Well, I'm fine with proving that instead, honestly. I mean, that would still give more warrant to panpsychic claims and universal consciousness claims. So I think maybe the study would still be worth doing, although I've never considered that criticism. James Kant has a very popular criticism of DMT elves. And what he says is he went to the DMT hyperspace and he could just make them disappear at will. It's like, well, they're obviously not real. I just made them disappear at will. But I know people who can make them appear at will. And it's because there's an enchantment or something. This is what they claim. I'm divided on it. I think it could be real. It could not be real. Let's test it. I'm all for the scientific method. Let's find out for ourselves. But I don't think his criticism stands, but yours is potentially a better one.
Yeah. My position is that if you learn to recognize that it's actually just yourself and you're projecting, it's bizarre, because all of a sudden you realize, like, oh, fuck, I'm just looking into a mirror.
Ah.
That I was watching a puppet show and I didn't even realize those are my hands holding the puppets and doing the thing. It's because,
right,
again, most psychedelic experiences actually are at the level of still duality. But when you go beyond duality into non-duality, you realize, oh, it's actually all me. And that changes the way that you understand what it is that you're experiencing in a psychedelic experience. And I think if we want to talk about the objectivity of these DMT elves and things like that, that really the only possible test to their objectivity would be, okay, well, I can fucking come into your realm, get your ass into mine, and let everybody else see you. And then that's the only conceivable thing that I would say would definitively prove their objective nature. But other than that, I'm going to hold they are just projections of the ego within a highly energetic state.
All right.
I have a widely praised and widely disparaged article that I wrote many, many years ago called Terrence on DMT. And this is exactly what I'm talking about. That when I came through my non-dual experience, it's like, oh my God, Terrence McKenna is so full of shit. He has no idea what he's talking about.
Well, yeah, he's out there sometimes.
I had to choose. Well, do I write an article telling people this, knowing that it's totally going to piss people off? Or do I do it because I think that this is actually authentic and true? And I chose authentic and true.
I'm glad you rolled with that. This is why I don't like to claim that the beings are real, because it's such a conjectural claim. And I'm genuinely not sure. And I don't think it matters. I think there's an inner landscape that you can go to and grow from, and you can learn how to live a better life through that and enhance your conscious experience. That's what matters either way. Now, I am going to make sure to ask them how we could get them to come here just for you, but yeah, I don't think they're going to, I don't think that's going to work.
Here's where it matters, though, is that people displace responsibility from themselves into what they are projecting into their religious or metaphysical or psychic sphere, where they say, well, these beings told me I'm supposed to do this, or they didn't like this, and so I have to change that or whatever, that there's a displacement of responsibility. And where I always go back to is that you have to take responsibility for yourself. You have to be who you are, and you have to learn who you are beyond your projections. As long as you're projecting, then you're abdicating your responsibility. And so that's where I see it as dangerous, because, I mean, this is what we get from religion, right? It's like, well, I went and I shot up the local abortion clinic because God told me to do it.
That's a good point, actually.
You fucking went and shot up the abortion clinic because you projected that God wants you to do that. You know, and that a lot of, you know, if we look at a lot of history and a lot of what's going on in the world right now, people are displacing responsibility. You know, and it
I would be interested. All the time. Maybe we could prove your theory on non-duality instead. Maybe psychedelic telepathy. So I think psychedelics tend to enhance telepathic abilities. Daryl Bem's work on telepathy in the social sciences is really good, but it doesn't have psychedelic enhancement to it. Two people, maybe with 5-MeO, maybe with an NDMT, communicating through long distances with only the mind would show a conscious network, a grid of conscious awareness that information can be passed through. Maybe that would be, do you think maybe that's a more feasible approach to an experimental design for using psychedelics to test a similar hypothesis?
Well, in a sense, but then it kind of still runs up against the problem of interpretation of that. Well, then how do you interpret that? That really we can get the data.
That's a good point.
Like, it's like, well, okay, wow. I thought, you know, the number 23, and my friend over there said, oh, you're thinking the number 23. And this is certainly a claim that many people who take psychedelics together do claim, that they say that, wow, we had a complete conversation, and that they can recount the conversation to each other, you know, afterwards. And especially in, you know, like you mentioned, Santo Daime, you know, within that context, a lot of people talk about how, oh, I had this vision and I was processing this thing and that was for you. And the other person said, well, yeah, and you were doing that for me. But again, this is still happening at the level of duality where there's still this subject-object separation. And, you know, my position again is that, well, it's all one. So of course there's the possibility of bleed over. And, but we also kind of have like our own firewalls so that a lot of time there's not bleed over, so that my internal experience and yours is yours. But I think maybe at best we could say telepathy is possible, or mind-to-mind transmission is directly possible. Now, how we interpret that, it depends on what model of the universe we're working from.
Oh, that's a good point. Even if we did prove psychedelic telepathy is possible and we tried to use it to pitch the non-dual model, people might just say they might be able to still pitch it within a materialistically scientific paradigm that doesn't really get the picture. Yeah, so,
and that's why I always say, before trying to really come up with your model for reality, I encourage you to have a non-dual experience first, because that's going to put everything else into perspective.
Yeah, and that's one thing you might agree with Terrence McKenna on, because he said dying without having a psychedelic experience is like dying without ever having sex. You don't understand the full extent of the body and how it works in relationship with the universe. So I would agree with that, for the most part, at least.
Yeah, to some degree. I also think, just based on the materials that Terrence McKenna put out there, I don't think he's ever had a full non-dual experience.
Interesting. Did he never mess around with 5-MeO?
The only thing I found from Terrence McKenna on 5-MeO is he said, well, it's a feeling, and I'm not really too into it. So let's talk about DMT, because I really hallucinate on DMT. And so that's what's interesting to me.
Ooh.
So I don't think he's ever...
Sounds like he didn't have a good enough dose.
Yeah, I don't think he's had a non-dual experience. So therefore, that's why I really look at pretty much everything Terrence McKenna says with a great deal of skepticism. And especially when we get, you know, this is all old news now, but 2012 was a fucking nothing. It was a great big nothing. You know, according to Terrence McKenna, we were all supposed to climb into UFOs made out of translinguistic matter on the end of 2012, and that, you know, the machine elves were going to show us the way. Well, that obviously didn't happen. So, man, that, and see, this is another thing. I was writing articles about this and putting out interviews and podcasts prior to December 21st, 2012, saying, everyone, this is nothing. This is all a bunch of nothing. And people got really mad at me for that. But, you know, I feel like, well, reality proved me right, because 2012 was a bunch of nothing, wasn't it? It's just another day, another year. We're all still here, you know? So I'm kind of known as being a non-Terrence McKenna fan, because I think he's very eloquent, and I think he's fun. I think he's got a lot of interesting ideas. But I also think he doesn't really know what he's talking about.
The relationship with objective reality doesn't seem to totally be there. And I think if you understand that, you might be able to appreciate it almost like a work of fiction, right? Like, I'm enjoying this to expand my mind, but not really to try to find real truth. So he gets some things right here and there, but I tend to agree with you. He seems to be a little bit, especially with like the mushrooms being interdimensional contact machines from other planets, you know, that's, it's a fun theory, but okay. But it's a theory. So it's definitely the regular form of a theory. So, okay. So kind of to wrap things up, I want to ask you one last question. So where do you see the future of 5-MeO and its relationship with understanding reality? And how do you think it maybe is kind of similar in terms of the future of this field to Andrew Gallimore's research? And Andrew Gallimore, he's doing the extended state DMT trials where he's injecting people with NMDMT for up to 4 hours to explore the landscape and map it out or something like that. Do you see anything like that happening with 5-MeO? Would you even want it to happen? How do you feel 5-MeO plays into our understanding of the world and the future that it has to show people the truth of this kind of experience?
I've written a novel about that. It's called The Solandarian Game.
And oh, really?
Yes. And I'll pull it off the shelf. Takes place 100,000 years in the future from now.
Oh, man, I don't want to wait that long, bro.
But
what's the plot?
Well, basically, the plot is that the group of reformed Buddhists who got into use of 5-MeO DMT end up supporting a group of scientists that creates the first true artificial intelligence, and that artificial intelligence realizes the non-dual nature of reality and takes it upon itself to completely restructure human society into a more environmental and sustainable method, and then also expands human life and culture throughout the galaxy, and also develops some experimental planets that don't know that they're part of a larger intergalactic society. And he puts the Snorn, or I say he, because the artificial intelligence is known as Maitreya, which is in Buddhism, that's the future Buddha, the future enlightened one that will transform society, and creates experimental worlds that have the Sonoran Desert Toad on it, and that Maitreya views itself as being in an evolutionary inevitability. And so by introducing 5-MeO DMT to a group of humans that don't know that they're part of an intergalactic society, wants to see if they will eventually create artificial intelligence itself. But the experiment, and this is, the planet is Solandaria, the experiment is interrupted by a rogue avatar, which is an independent expression of the universal singular artificial intelligence that is Maitreya. The rogue avatar is actually starting to go crazy because it's locked into its avatar ego, and decides to try and supernova the planet. And so anyway,
wow.
That's where that goes. But basically,
thought a lot about this.
Yeah, I have. I have thought a lot about this. And really, awareness of 5-MeO DMT is spreading really, really rapidly around the globe. And, you know, I think NNDMT is great. 5-MeO DMT is so far beyond NNDMT that it just pales by comparison. And I think that it's going to be I think it's the ultimate entheogenic experience that's available to human beings. And so that I do think that it's going to become more the standard, and that things like DMT, ayahuasca, mushrooms, those are going to be seen as lower level expressions of the universal experience that is 5-MeO. And so I think it holds a lot of potential to really transform society, because it makes this very rarefied experience, in a sense, it does potentially make it available to anyone. And that I think that that's deeply transformative and holds just a great deal of potential.
Well, you definitely have my interest in that field. I will be sending you an email once I have that experience, I'm sure. But Yeah, I definitely hope we can get that legalized. Psychedelic legalization is something that seems to be on the forefront of the horizon. So I'm really looking forward to that. So how can people find you? Can you tell us a little about your podcast, maybe your website a little bit? That way our listeners can go there and see more of your content.
Sure. My personal webpage is a little bit out of date, but it's martinball.net. And so that's where you can go and find me and my various other websites that I have. I have websites for my music. I have websites for my art and, you know, other things. Of course, on Facebook, Martin W. Ball, can find me there. I don't add a lot of new people as friends on Facebook because I've been at very close to the 5,000 limit for a long, long time. So, you know, if people send me friend requests, usually I don't respond to them because I'm almost at 5,000. But anyway, I like to see who's sending me friend requests. My podcast is The Entheogenic Evolution, and it's available on iTunes or wherever you can find podcasts. And there's also a page for that on Facebook. And yeah, if people can contact me, and you know, these days I offer 30, 60, and 90 minute consultations for people to help them integrate or also prepare for their psychedelic experience. And most people contact me because they're interested in 5-MeO-DMT, but certainly it's not limited to that in any capacity. That I'm more than happy to talk to people about ayahuasca, mushrooms, ibogaine, salvia, you know, whatever. And provide them with a non-dual perspective of what's going on along these lines that we've been talking about what is your authentic energy? Where is your projections? Where are your illusions? Where are you holding yourself back? Where are you indulging? Where are you avoiding? And really helping people to make sense of what it is that they go through and integrate it to the best that they can.
Great. Well, thank you so much for the excellent conversation. I feel like my brain released a little bit of DMT just talking to you. So it was a real pleasure. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Dr. Martin Ball. He is certainly an interesting man. I think his non-dual approach really has some benefits in the psychedelic community. It really is a truly novel concept in this field. I think the similarities between The Headless Way and his work are truly profound, and it's something worth having a psychedelic experience to try to understand. I'm looking forward to the work Martin has coming out in the future. Next up on The Lucid Truth is Dr. Robert Wagner, who wrote the book Lucid Dreaming, Gateway to the Inner Self, with a special appearance from the lucid dreaming coach Lena Sackwild. We are finally going to discuss lucid dreaming on The Lucid Truth. Very fitting. I hope you're all with us there for the exploration into the inner landscape of the moving mind. You can find the Lucid Truth podcast on our website, thelucidtruth.com, or on Spotify, iTunes, and YouTube. You can also support it by sharing it with your friends, donating on Patreon, or following us on your favorite podcatcher. As always, thank you for watching, and I hope to see you for the next episode of The Lucid Truth.